Good afternoon, everyone. Thanks for hanging in there. This is a very information-dense conference, and by this time of the afternoon, it's a little much. But this is going to be a bit different than what you're accustomed to hearing, because I'm not going to be giving you facts, figures, graphs, etc. I'm going to be talking to you about people's hearts and what's really in their hearts and minds, because that's really what's going to lead this industry in one direction or another. First of all, thank you very much for inviting me, Jeff. I appreciate that. And it's really very much an honor to be here. A little bit about myself. I'm the director of Sustainable Obtainable Solutions, which is a nonprofit I founded in 2001, focused on ensuring the sustainability of public lands and the sustainability of the plant, animal, and the human communities that depend on public lands. And as such, I found myself working a lot in climate change, in forest health, in biomass, in large landscape conservation strategies. And when I learned about biomass, thanks to an article by Kelby Wilson in 2007, I believe it was, that I realized biochar was sitting there, right there in the center of all the things that I was working on. And so I started the U.S. Biochar Initiative in 2009, primarily to ensure that what we were doing when we approached biochar, which I was sure was going to be a wonderful solution to so many of our problems, that we were going to do it sustainably. And the reason that I was so concerned about that is because I had spent last century, 23 years last century, working for the U.S. Forest Service. My degree is in landscape architecture, and my passion and interest is in how people relate to their landscapes, that relationship between humans and their environments. And it's very telling. My career also led me to be a forest supervisor on one of the largest, the largest national forest in the continental U.S. So I spent an incredible amount of time dealing directly with people, trying to understand their feelings, desires, and their relationship to these public lands that are our national treasure chests of resources. And I was also fortunate to be one of the developers, founders, developers, and innovators of the human dimensions of ecosystem management. And that's going to be at the core of my talk today. We know what the dimensions are of our environment, atmosphere, biosphere, lithosphere, but the whole thing is actually parts and pieces of the human sphere. So when we look at ecosystem management, how we are going to manage our natural resources, how we're going to allow them to be used or force them to be used, there's three components: the biological, the physical, and the human. Now, those of you working in soils know that you're bouncing around in the physical and the biological. But the human dimension is just as important. If we do not pay attention to and understand the human aspect of landscapes and ecosystems, then we're not going to be able to manage them correctly, and we're not going to get to the outcomes that we desire. So what is the human dimension, really? Well, in this relationship with our environment, there are wants, needs, there's goods and services that we seek. We want experiences. We want to form memories. We want to form a relationship with our landscapes. Our landscapes inform us about culture, and they also inform how we express that culture. How do people, you know, you think of Eskimos. What informs their building? It's ice, it's snow, it's igloos. You know, and you can go through every human environment, and their environment will inform how they dress themselves, feed themselves, educate themselves, give themselves medication. And so it's extremely important. Also, we look at landscapes to not only as part of our history, where we came from, but also part of our legacy. What are we leaving when we exit this place? And there are also metaphysical relationships to landscapes. So when we look at this, we're really talking about people's health, their total health, their physical health, their economic health, their emotional health. And so why are human dimensions important in biochar? Because the human dimensions are what forms people's beliefs and their values. And people act from their beliefs and values. Now, it would be wonderful if people acted from fact. But people don't really act from facts as much as they react from their values and beliefs. And I discovered in my Forest Service career that all natural resource decisions are social decisions. So we can roll that directly into biochar production, and all biochar choices are actually social choices. So if we can get the public to want, understand, and support biochar, then they will become consumers. If they become consumers and supporters, they bring on other consumers and supporters by word of mouth, the strongest form of advertising. And what does that result in? That results in policy and economic decisions that allow us to move forward in the biochar industry. Because nothing gets done without public support. So, we are examining these human dimensions of biochar so that we know what the benefits are, how we can get social permission to continue, and how we can create markets. So, quickly, just looking at the biochar benefits and uses, I think a lot of people have touched on these, but essentially we're looking at primary productivity being enhanced, remediation, carbon sequestration, ecosystem services, which is a plethora of services and absolutely essential, and also enhancing human conditions. Biochar in soils, again, capture and hold nutrients in water, can raise the pH, it can improve the texture, increase the carbon, reduce carbon or greenhouse gas emissions. On the farm, feeding it to our livestock, reducing methane emissions, for instance, in cattle, putting it in litter, using it on farm fields, using it on crops such as bluegrass, which is the example here on your right. And that was at 10 tons per acre on application rates on that bluegrass on extremely acidic soils in the Palouse. Because of the over-fertilization of the Palouse soils in southeastern Washington, we have extreme acidification dropping down into the 4 to 4.5 range, which barley won't even grow in that. Reclamation and its relationship with water quality in particular, this is an example of the Hope Mine is just above the watershed for Carbondale, Colorado, and these slopes were unable to be revegetated until there was this experimentation with a compost biochar blend, and just 10% or 15% biochar in the compost resulted in 1 year in this kind of growth. Stabilization and in protecting the watershed. Renewable energy with benefits. John Bonnets mentioned this, as did a number of the other speakers. If we're just producing biochar, we're not capturing its full value. We're not achieving the economic and environmental qualities that we really want. If we can produce power from it, capture the heat, in this case, the heat is captured and heats a greenhouse. The biochar is also used as a growth medium in here. So suddenly we're closing the loop here and making it a lot more sustainable system, co-products, co-benefits, and co-support. Carbon storage, yes, carbon market. It would be so good to get a carbon market that actually functioned and did not immediately give a whole lot of benefits to corporations so that they actually had a lot of extra carbon bennies to play with and they actually had to pay for each unit of carbon. And that would make a huge difference. In the case of biochar, the beauty of biochar in terms of carbon sequestration is it's taking carbon out of the active cycle and putting it into the inactive cycle, which is the absolute reverse of what we're doing with fossil fuels. And that kind of an explanation, every audience I talk to, and I talk to a lot of lay people about biochar, everybody gets that. They might not believe in global warming, but they can understand when you take something out of one place and put it in another, if that makes sense. Human health, just a few of the examples. Cleaner air when cooking and heating. Women who cook over open stoves, open fires in huts have about a 45-year lifespan. Their family not much longer than that either. Biochar, when you ingest it, I used to be an EMT. We always carried charcoal with us because if you had any issue of poisoning, pop it in the patient and it would absorb that poison. Absorptive clothing. These are some new uses, putting biochar into clothing to help absorb odors and moisture and humidity control, air and water filters, building insulation, concrete additive, plaster additives, electromagnetic applications. And so there's a whole lot of other uses for biochar rather than just putting it into the soil. So these kinds of uses would also call for a much higher price. So we won't be talking about how many cubic yards we needed for a jacket or how many tons we needed to put into plaster to control humidity and odor and mold. Instead, we'd be talking about much smaller quantities. So let's some biochar economic potential. We're not there yet with biochar. We know that. But biochar, particularly on a local scale, it's non-discriminatory. Anybody can get involved in biochar, either as a user, producer, or a provider of feedstock. It's scalable. You can do anything from very, very tiny to very large. The small right now is good because the small is how we reach people. The small is how people get excited and talk to their neighbors. I speak to 2 master gardeners and suddenly I have 20 master gardeners calling me. I have 20 master gardeners saying, let's build a community kiln and then conduct our own experiments. You know, so you can get people excited on a local scale. Take advantage of this emphasis on localization. I think it's also probably we're going to find eventually when we get extremely sophisticated that using local feedstocks is actually much better fit for the soils at which the feedstocks will be, or the product will be applied. Affordable. Some of us roll our eyes and go, oh my God, it's not affordable. Well, depending on the scale and the technology used, it can be affordable. Very diverse feedstock. So just about any place that has any biomass that can be converted thermally is a place where biochar can be made. And again, local. You have your best return on investment, your best energy return on energy invested, and your best life cycle assessment when you're looking at local production, local distribution, and local sources of your feedstock. Humans need immediate rewards, or they don't want to play. And we've been training our consumer society to expect immediate rewards. Are you mad because you're not getting a download in 2 seconds? You should have it in 1 or less. So immediately, if you're making biochar, you have energy, heat, you're converting waste. Short-term, soil enhancement, water retention, crop productivity, things that we can understand in the next couple of years. But long-term, look at what's happening. We not only capture all our short-term gains, but we also get the carbon sequestration, and we get the repetition of the water holding capabilities and all those other wonderful things that biochar can do for us. But there's community benefits. Really key is the issue of waste. I was able to get a grant in the state of Washington because I was talking about waste, not because I was talking about biochar, but we have hundreds of thousands of tons of biomass waste in the state of Washington that are not going into useful products at this point in time. So this is a way to start to capture that, to get people thinking about, wait a minute, I call it waste, but a better term I heard, a secondary resource. Food security. Food security is becoming extremely important, and it's going to become more so as perturbations in climate and the weather cause people to lose crops, whether they're a small farm or a market farm or a grain producer, hay producer. Do-it-yourself equipment. People can make this equipment themselves, or they can jury-rig some existing equipment. There's a guy living in a town of about 150 people. He came to one of my biochar talks. He said, well, I use a gasifier to supply, the entire power for my shop. Well, 20 people marched over to him at the end of the session. Tell me more. How do you do that? Small business opportunities. Also, a spinoff of one of my talks on biochar, somebody started to make cone kilns in their backyard. And then a tribe that has a metalworking shop that they've converted to a training center is like, well, we could make own kilns. So this is starting to stimulate people's creativity. You can market the technology or the product, and you can benefit the local environment economy. These are messages the county commissioners want to hear. So biomass, love it, need it, want it. Who's going to get it first? Well, us humans say biomass is carbon-based material, when sufficiently dry, can be thermally converted to energy and other byproducts. Well, there's another definition. Nature has a whole different take on biomass. Complex structure, nutrients, moisture, temperature regulators, shelter, food, home, carbon sequestration. So who gets to use biomass for what purpose? Because biomass is also doing all these other ecological functions, erosion control, mycelial support, food, shelter for wildlife and us, wildfire control. Renewability, biomass renews all the time. Availability, it's all over the place. Accessibility, we can get to it. Demand, and you have a very high potential for overuse and a very high potential for not having the sufficient amount for what you think is the best application for it. We know how to find it, salvage it, produce it, handle it, haul it, maul it, measure it, process it, heat it, beat it, convert it. We can do anything. But first, before we do that, we need to get permission from all the other people who have an interest in biomass. We need that social permission. Now, we have forms of social permission that, such as biochar standards, biochar characterizations, licenses, leases, contracts, incentives, financing, etc. But it's the other side, the relationship mechanisms, that we need the social permission for. Because social permission directly influences public policy. We can't know all the factions that are opposed. It's difficult to identify the real issues. And we can appease, compromise, mitigate, and all that. They're only temporary until we get to the root cause. Why are people opposed? We need to find that sweet spot, and that is the sustainability spot, where social, environment, and economics all come together. Biomass to energy concerns. These are so real, and there are so many bad examples of these things actually happening. This is what will stop us, because one bad thing happens and it becomes a poster child, and we will hear about it. Using animal feed, human food, as a feedstock is not going to cut it. Conversion of croplands to grow biomass. Conversion of conservation reserve program lands. We haven't been presented a very convincing argument for that. Industrial scale production or collection of biomass that denudes or dramatically changes a local ecosystem will not be permitted. Transportation, carbon footprint and cost, toxic feedstocks, ecologically unsustainable biomass amounts being removed from forests and farms, and screwing with the visual quality or wildlife habitat. You want people to light their hair on fire and say no. They may not tell you that these are the real reasons, but these are very strong reasons. People don't like ugly. Nature doesn't do ugly. If nature is doing ugly or looks ugly, something's wrong, and people will turn to the people who are doing it and say, stop it. So, the things that we need to consider: soil productivity and structure, biodiversity and habitat, air and water quality, visual quality, landscape and community character, EROI, output-input balance, goes beyond energy, environmental quality, and environmental justice and social equity. So, highest value with the least waste first. Upcycle. I preach intercept the waste stream for biochar. Don't try to grow a biocrop or a crop and use that for biomass. Use value-added products, co-products, stack your functions, get multiple uses out of that biochar, and at the minimum, capture carbon. You know your EROI and LCA, and this is the last slide. So these are some guidelines. I worked with John Miedema in the Pacific Northwest Biochar Group, and we came up with actually we have 16 pages of sustainability guidelines. But the keys are right here, which all respond directly to the things that I was just talking about. And we need to convince people that we're actually doing this, regardless of what use we're putting that biomass to. And that's just a continuation, but educate and be educated is key. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
I love talks like this because it gets me out of my biochar box. So, are there any questions? Yes, sir.
I understand your advocacy on biochar, but I strongly disagree with some of the points. One of your points was that if you still primary productivity,
was just referencing that the growth has a tendency to be increased when biochar is used. Well, the slide that I showed of one of the two examples of growth trials with biochar showed a significant increase in root and above ground growth.
Yeah, but then that's in your greenhouse condition, not in the
field. It wasn't in greenhouse, it was field conditions.
Field conditions, then how much was it developed? What is the cost? If I'm a farmer, I would like to see that dramatic increase of my productivity.
The example that I was using was a bluegrass field in Rockford, Washington. The farmer is a producer of biochar. He uses his bluegrass chaff, and he is applying it broadly to his fields. So I'm not quoting statistics, but I'm just saying that in general, biochar does seem to increase plant growth.
You don't see that. I don't see any published data. Biochar changes over time. You need to see 5 years data. That should be on a principle. We don't have that. So you can't really recommend.
All right, that is your belief, and I have my belief, and so I guess this is a perfect example of the human dimensions of biochar.
We have a discussion period scheduled after this. The next speaker will join us at 3:25. I would encourage you to continue this if you feel like it during the discussion period. Until then, I will see you in about 12-13 minutes. Thank you.